Welcome to today's program titled Protecting Trade Secrets Abroad and Enforcing Rights Abroad and in the U.S. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I'd like to turn the program over to Dan Hart. You may begin.
Well, good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, depending on where in the world you're listening to this webinar. My name is Dan Hart. I'm a partner in Seyfarth Shaw's Labor and Employment Group based in the Atlanta office. And it's my privilege to welcome you to this, the sixth installment in our 2018 Trade Secrets webinar series. Over the next 60 minutes or so, we're going to provide you with an update on trade secrets law in the international context. And to help you navigate through these issues, we're delighted to have some of our resident experts with us today. I'll be joined today by Marjorie Culver, a partner in the International Group based in Seyfarth Shaw's New York office. I'll also be joined by Paul Yovanic, an associate in the Litigation Group in Chicago. And finally, I'll be joined by my Atlanta colleague, Alex Meyer, who is an associate in the Labor and Employment Group. Now, the slide on the screen lists our aims for today. To get started, Marjorie and Paul will provide an overview of rules for enforcing trade secrets protection in several notable jurisdictions around the world, with a particular focus on Europe, China, the UAE, and Australia. They'll also provide an overview of best practices for multinational employers in protecting trade secrets in the international context. Alex will then provide an overview of remedies that are available to employers here in the U.S. for misappropriation of trade secrets abroad. Alex will also discuss remedies that are now available domestically under the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which has now been in place for a little over 2 years. Finally, I'll then provide what I hope are some practical tips to help multinational employers protect their trade secrets and other confidential information across multiple jurisdictions. And now, with no further ado, I'll hand it over to Marjorie and Paul.
Thank you, Dan. As Dan said, my name is Paul Yovanic, and I'm an associate in the Chicago office here at Seyfarth Shaw. We're going to begin by jumping right into updates surrounding the EU directive on the protection of trade secrets. As many of you may be aware, the EU directive was adopted on June 8, 2016, and was designed to bring European law in line with stronger provisions such as the United States Defend Trade Secrets Act and China's anti-unfair competition law. As such, the EU directive gave all member states 2 years until June 9, 2018 to establish laws, regulations, and administrative provisions necessary to protect trade secrets. We have now provided some examples in the next few slides of countries implementing trade secret laws in accordance with the EU directive. For example, with France, the Constitutional Council validated France's law on the protection of trade secrets on July 26, 2018. The law protects against information that is not generally known or easily accessible to those familiar with this type of information because of their sector activity. However, the Act also requires that information to be of commercial value, whether actual or potential, because of its secret nature and subject to reasonable protection measures by its legitimate holder, given the circumstances, to maintain its secret nature. Under French law, the court has judicial discretion to punish the perpetrator of the infringement and to compensate the damage suffered by the company. the court has the power to prohibit the continued use of protected information or prohibit the placing of products on the market that resulted from the infringement of trade secrets. Also, the court has its discretion to order the recall or destruction of disputed products. Furthermore, the court shall have the power to order, as a precautionary measure, the payment of compensation to the injured party where such payment appears more reasonable than the prohibited measures just discussed. The law provides for four exceptions where use or disclosure of the secret is permitted. The first exception is where disclosure is required or authorized by EU law. The second exception is where an infringer is exercising their right to freedom of expression and communication. The third exception is where the secret is revealed for the purpose of protecting the public interest and in good faith, unlawful activity, misconduct, or reprehensible conduct. The final exception is disclosure of trade secret for protection of a legitimate interest recognized by EU or national law. Finally, and while I did not list this in the slide, abuse of the law does not come without punishment. Abuse of the law or frivolous claims can be subject to a fine of up to 20% of any damages claimed by the plaintiff. However, the fine is still under review, and the French Constitutional Council recently censored the fine this summer, so it'll be something interesting to keep an eye on moving forward. As far as the United Kingdom, prior to June 9, 2018, trade secrets in the UK were protected by the law of confidence, which was derived from principles of equity and based almost entirely on case law. That means that there was no statute defining a trade secret and no standalone legislation dealing with the potential procedural safeguards and remedies required under the EU directive. So as you can see on the slide here, there's a definition of the UK's trade secret. Looking at this definition, parts A and B are broadly the same as what was in the law of confidence. However, part C introduces a new element. By contrast, under the law of confidence, it is necessary to show that information was imparted in circumstances of confidence. While there is likely to be a large overlap so that most information protected by the existing law of confidence will also be protected under the new law, the two tests are not quite equivalent. As a result, some information could lose its protection unless businesses show that they have taken steps to protect their information. As such, businesses should consider auditing their trade secret protections to ensure that the information complies with the third element under the new law. Unlike France and the UK, Germany still does not have its trade secret law implemented. However, it is expected to be enacted in December of this year. What we know so far is that Germany's trade secret law will protect technical information such as drawings, methods, ingredients, recipes, as well as business information, which includes customer data, purchasing prices, and market studies. Germany's new law is limited to information that is subject to actual and reasonable measures to maintain its secrecy. This is something that did not exist in the past. One thing to be aware of is that Germany's new law will permit reverse engineering unless it's otherwise contractually prohibited. Reverse engineering includes deconstruction of a third-party product to reveal its design or to extract information from the product. Again, freedom to reverse engineer did not exist in the past, and therefore, companies that conduct business in Germany will want to consider clauses against reverse engineering in agreements with suppliers, customers, and R&D developers. Unfortunately, this will obviously not prevent competitors from attempting to reverse engineer a product. As such, companies may want to explore IP rights, such as patents, to protect valuable designs still. Finally, the new law will hold a company liable for infringement of trade secrets, even if the company has not acted culpably. Since there will now be a greater risk when hiring an employee from a competitor, companies will want to revise employment contracts to provide a clear understanding that new hires are prohibited from bringing over information that is proprietary to their former employer. I will now turn it over to Marjorie Culver to discuss restrictive covenant issues in the EU.
Thanks, Paul. I think one thing to keep in mind when we talk about the updates to the these trade secret laws and the directive is that there isn't a similar uniform approach with regard to restrictive covenants such as non-competes, non-solicits. Each country has their own requirements for these obligations, and so when you're looking at the Europe as a region, it creates some challenges for companies who have a significant presence there as a regional headquarters. What do you do if you have a high-level executive in Switzerland who has a non-compete and suddenly they go to work for a competing business in Germany or France? There's not really a European non-compete that meets all the requirements of those various countries. There's no standard. One of the things to think about in terms of how they vary, you know, certainly duration. They all require that you have a legitimate business interest. I think one thing to keep in mind is the geographic scope. Some countries take a more parochial view, and courts will only likely enforce it within that particular country. They won't enforce it, for example, on the basis of the whole region, you know, EMEA or even EU. Also, one way they vary greatly is payment. Some countries require payment for a non-compete, some don't. So in our example of the executive in Switzerland moving to Germany, Switzerland doesn't require payment for a non-compete during the non-compete period. Germany does. So what happens when someone goes to work for a competitor in Germany and you want to enforce that non-compete? You bring it to a German court, and the German court will say, well, this doesn't have payment. So this doesn't comply with our non-compete law for restriction. So I think when you think about your strategy for Europe, again, in this extra layer of protection on top of what's in the law, right, trade secret or confidentiality, you have to think about how your regional view and how you're going to protect your assets in a very strategic and targeted manner. So, for example, one thing to consider is, do we have our top executives that have responsibility for that region? Do we try to prepare a non-compete that does take into account their ability to move to these other countries? And even if where they are located now, Switzerland, doesn't require payment, do you build in a payment feature that might help you in countries that require payment? France, Italy, Belgium, Germany, if they were to move to a competitor in those locations. So that's just one thing to think about in considering that there isn't a really harmonized approach. I think that one way this comes up is if you have a global mobility program and you're sending someone from the United States, for example, to Europe, and they are going to work in either Switzerland or Germany or France, I think you need to take into account that you're anticipating they're going to return to the U.S., but they could get poached and go to work for another company there in the EU once they have that experience. I think it's important to anticipate for that expat, are you protecting yourself locally as well as in the home country? And I think that is something to consider, particularly where your expat executives, they may do a stint of 2 years in Switzerland, you know, another 2 years in Germany, then maybe they go off to Japan. I think it's important to really think locally. Every time something about that assignment changes, that's your opportunity to think about how you will draft in anticipation of what is their changed situation now. Maybe they had a very small role when they went over there as an expat, and that has, in their assignments, grown and become a more regional role or a global role. It's very important to keep up to date with those changes when you're thinking about your expatriate assignments. So, Paul, maybe back to you on China.
Great. Thank you, Marjorie. We're now going to move on to protecting trade secrets in China. China's anti-unfair competition law was amended on November 4, 2017, and became effective at the beginning of this year. The definition of a trade secret under the AUCL protects technical information or business information which is unknown to the public, has commercial value, and for which the rights owner has taken corresponding measures to ensure confidentiality. Under the old version of the law, the information was required to possess practical value. Now, information with negative value will be protected, such as a failed test result. The idea behind this is that while failed test results are not part of the trade secret, it arguably led to the success and value of the protected secret, thus giving it a unique protectable value. Moreover, the revised law provides clarity on the third-party involvement in trade secret infringement cases. Third parties will now be held liable for trade secret infringement where the third party is aware that the trade secret was obtained through illegal means. Violations for the trade secret infringement can range from the equivalent of $15,000 to $77,000 for general cases and $77,000 to $460,000 for serious cases. As best practices to protect trade secrets in China, companies should ensure that employees are educated concerning the confidentiality of information and their obligations. Label documents and information confidential where necessary. Only permit necessary employees to access trade secret information. Utilize confidentiality agreements with employees. Ensure information is well protected from internal and external hacking. And similarly, conduct regular risk assessments to determine security threats to ensure that the information is being secure. Now I'm going to turn it back over to Marjorie again to discuss restrictive covenant issues in China and abroad.
Great, thank you. In China, we've picked some examples here. China's one, and then in the next slides, the UAE and Australia, where drafting conventions are really important in your non-compete and your restrictive covenant approach. And they're certainly not the examples of the only countries, but they're good examples to show some of the things you'll find in some of the other countries, especially in the particular way they're drafted. And what I think this shows is you really need a local approach in your restrictive covenants. There are a lot of concepts, I think, that are universal, but there are some nuances and conventions that I think you have to keep in mind. So, for example, China is one of these countries where payment is required, and it differs by region, whether in Shanghai or Beijing. There is a minimum understood amount of compensation that you need to provide for each month of the non-compete. I think that one thing that's important to keep in mind for China is that enforcement is very difficult in the way that we understand it. Getting an injunction is a very difficult thing to do. So you have to look at in your non-compete drafting, what are my other levers for this? Is there a penalty? Is there a liquidated damages clause? Is there some kind of penalty that I can impose? So you really have to look at a local approach there in how you're going to enforce that agreement. You know, similarly, and these are technical issues, it definitely has to be in the local language. And if you don't, chances are, if you don't have a wet signature on that and you go to court, that will be a way for a court to side with the employee that it's not enforceable. So these are conventions to keep in mind. And as we, go forward when, in the next section, we're talking about the UAE, this is another example of conventions that are important. So one thing to keep in mind in the UAE is that, actually I'm going to ask to advance to the next slide. I don't think we're, yeah, great, thank you. In the UAE, it's very common that most of the people that you have working there are going to be expats. They are not going to be citizens of that country, nationals of that country. You are going to have almost everybody get a work permit to be able to work for you there. One of the requirements of that work permit is an employment contract, a local employment contract with the entity that's sponsoring the work permit. And that is the only contract that a court in the UAE will look at. So that is your opportunity to include a non-compete and get the best protection there. And like most countries, they have a reasonableness requirement. You have to show that it's to protect a legitimate business interest, confidential information. It has to be reasonable in time and scope. But also you have to ensure that that is in that local contract. It's going to be in the local language. And, you know, one thing to think about the UAE is their enforcement there is a little bit different. It can be very hard to get a preliminary injunction or a full injunction of that activity. So it's often common to have a liquidated damages clause or a penalty clause. You know, one mechanism that can work, and again, this would only work if you made sure that that clause was in that local contract that is needed to get the work permit, is you can get a ban from, you can impose a ban on working for a competitor on their in their work permit process. If they were to leave your company and go to another company and they need a work permit to do that, if you found that they had violated that non-compete, which was held to be lawful, you could ask for a restriction on that work permit or a ban on that work permit for them working for the competitor. And so why do I mention the local contract and how important that is? I mention that because it's very typical for those expats to have that local contract and then have another contract on top of that local contract that is really more in the style that a U.S. employee would have, right, or a U.S. executive would have. And a lot of companies, that's where they put the restrictive covenant. And while that might get you some contractual relief, it is not going to provide the same remedies that a locally provided non-compete in the official employment agreement is going to provide. So let's move on to Australia, because I think, again, this is going to show some of the conventions about drafting that I think are really, you know, particular there. But it is an example of, and they do show up in other countries. So, you know, Australia has a number of states, just like we do in the U.S., and every state has their own common law for what is enforceable with regard to what they call a restraint clause. This is very similar to the U.S. It has to be reasonable in time and in scope, and it has to protect a legitimate business interest. You can seek an injunction to prevent breach or further limit breach. Damages can be awarded. But I think that, you know, it's important to think about one issue we think about a lot in the U.S., which is a blue pencil. You know, what are the blue pencil rules? And they vary by state. So, for example, if you're in New South Wales, their sort of revision rules, blue pencil rules, you can cross things out, but you can't add anything. So you will commonly see in a non-compete agreement in New South Wales, for example, what they call a cascade. And so what does the territory look like, or what does the time period look like? You'll see it start off with the maximum time period, and then if that's not enforceable, a shorter time period or a more limited geography. And so you'll have a list getting narrower so that if a court finds that the covenant is too broad, it can actually cross out and make it more narrow, and you can still preserve that non-compete. So again, another example of keeping in mind local drafting considerations that could help enhance your protections. So next slide. So again, you know, when you're thinking about Australia, and these are some additional considerations, I think one thing to the top of this list here is the negotiation process. They will look at, you know, is this just cookie cutter? Is it something that the individual had some meaningful input into? So I think that's the additional, and in addition to the other elements here in thinking about our the enforceability of our covenants, that's something to keep in consideration. Not all countries require that, but that is something to think about. In addition to the length of the restraint, which we've talked about, you know, what the business, what is it that you're protecting about the business? You know, it shouldn't, the covenant should not be so broad as to not have any relation to the business where it can't be any, it can't be obvious to the judge. And, you know, geographic restraint, again, think about what is the history of the court. So are they only limiting it to France, for example? Are French courts allowing it for all of Europe? These are all the same considerations that we see, you know, in Australia and the UAE. With Australia, it's regard, they'll look at states just like we do in the U.S. So these are the things to keep in mind when, you know, we say it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. There are a lot of common themes, but there are a lot of particular technical requirements that if you do have employees that are globally mobile and working for you in other countries, you need to keep in mind to best protect your intellectual property and your business, your competitive interests. So, Paul, back to you.
Great. Thank you, Marjorie. So now we are moving on to Dan and Alex to handle domestic remedies for international trade secret theft.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alex Meyer. I'm an associate in SIFAR's Atlanta office, and I have the privilege of sharing the most important information during the presentation, which is the CLE code. So it is SS, as in SIFAR Shaw, 8952. That's SS8952. I'm going to talk a little bit about litigating trade secrets violations, when you should consider doing so, and some of the related costs and benefits. Now, this part of the presentation assumes some familiarity with the baseline concepts, so we'll kind of skip over what the elements of a claim for trade secret misappropriation are and go into a little bit more depth for the new tools that have developed for litigating these violations, as well as modifications to some of the existing tools to remedy some form of intellectual property theft, like the International Trade Commission's Section 337 proceedings. So what we're going to do is go through the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which was passed, as Dan mentioned previously, a little bit more than 2 years ago. We'll talk about criminal prosecutions for trade secrets misappropriation, as well as the civil side of the equation, including changes to private litigation, the applicability of the act to foreign misappropriation, and how the DTSA modified what constitutes a predicate act for RICO claims, as well as International Trade Commission 337 violations, which is a little bit of a unique procedure that most of y'all probably associate more with litigating patent issues, but has recently had some additional developments for trade secrets misappropriation. And then finally, we'll just close with noting the potential for future maybe bilateral or multilateral trade agreements and how those might implicate your remedies for trade secrets theft as well. So first, I'm going to start off by going through what does it cost. So these figures come out of the 2017 American Intellectual Property Lawyers Association's Economic Survey. It consists of some sample results from approximately 1,200 attorneys who practice some form of intellectual property, including trademark, copyright, trade secrets, and patent, plus supplemental data provided by 205 law firms. So what we're looking at here is the estimated total cost for a lawsuit for trade secrets misappropriation with varying amounts in controversy. The first couple bars are for those with an amount in controversy of less than $1 million, and then the next set is for $1 to $10 million at risk. So to start off, it's worth noting that the actual amount in controversy number is a little bit fuzzy here because a lot of the times the main value in these suits is getting some kind of preliminary injunctive relief. And that can be difficult to value. In fact, that's one of the elements of getting it in the first place, is to show some kind of irreparable harm that cannot be remedied purely by monetary damages. But, you know, this tries to give you an idea when your business folks come to you and say, okay, well, we've got this action. What exactly is it going to cost to take us through here? And so, you know, probably the most notable thing is that there's a pretty wide band, primarily in discovery and taking it all the way through trial. The range for the $1 to $10 million band, including post-trial work, ranges from about $300,000 to $1.1 million. In my experience, this number seems a bit low on the low end and a little bit high on the high end, but I think that this is probably skewed by the number of times that these suits reach a resolution after the temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction stage. In terms of cost planning, the major events are whether you're going to move for preliminary injunctive relief, such as a TRO or a PI, and the amount of forensic work that's required. A preliminary injunction or TRO hearing usually requires pretty major outlays in a pretty short period of time. You might have expedited discovery. And second, associated forensic work can get pretty pricey as well, especially if you have a large number of devices that need to be imaged, such as a mass departure scenario, or where there are questions related to spoliation, where you might need to go into a compromised drive or engage in some more costly forensic techniques, such as carving the hard drive, to figure out whether the drive contained relevant data prior to the potential spoliation. One other interesting thing to note is the AIPLA provides the same information for the 10 to 25 million and then 25 million and up bands, and the values and figures remain about the same, even with the increase for the amount of controversy, with the exception of taking it to trial, in which case you see that the cost for doing that is somewhere between 2 and 3 times. That could be because of the amount of evidence required to establish that amount of damages. It could also be that there's simply just a longer range of conduct, which is why the amount of controversy is higher. The data isn't broken down finely enough to really get that granular on it. So the following slide, this is what we have for 337 proceedings. So this isn't exactly apples to apples, and we'll talk a little bit more later on about what a 337 proceeding is. But it's another potential avenue to protect against trade secret misappropriation with the importation of goods into the United States with some important limitations. But an important thing to note is that this is for patent 337 cases, so we're not exactly looking at an apples-to-apples comparison. There simply aren't enough trade secrets misappropriation cases for us to get the data on this for that particular subset of those proceedings. But it is worth noting that there's a much greater range for trial and discovery costs. That's probably a function of international discovery and some other facets that are unique to 337 proceedings that we'll discuss in a little bit more detail later. So going domestically, it's been a really cool time to be involved in trade secrets work because it's been in the news a lot. In 2016, Bloomberg had a front page cover story about a corporate espionage plot to steal the color white, which was the process for making titanium dioxide. The same year, Congress passed the DTSA, and we've seen an increased discussion about trade secrets in the public sphere, due in large part to the ongoing tariff exchanges with China, which were predicated in part for punishing China for, quote, years of stealing United States trade secrets. You had General Keith Alexander describing intellectual property theft as the single greatest wealth transfer in history. And PwC has ballparked the impact of stolen trade secrets and other forms of intellectual property at somewhere between 1 to 3% of GDP. You know, with this kind of rhetoric, you'd expect to see an increase in federal prosecutions. And you'd be sort of right. So we have seen a lot more headlines and more prosecutions by the federal government. In the abstract, you know, the concept of having the government sort of litigate your case for you with the added heft of potential criminal penalties sounds appealing, but we're not talking about a huge number of cases. And the government certainly has a type of case that it likes to go after. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this and when you might want to get the federal government involved and potentially open an investigation. So first of all, these are numbers that were provided by the most recent DOJ activity report for their cyber crimes division. And so you can see that there's a whopping 9 charges for theft of trade secrets in 2017, and even fewer for the year before that. We estimate that there's somewhere around 20 to 30 trade secret-related prosecutions in the last 3 years. The numbers aren't exactly concrete because the DOJ may or may not include prosecutions for conspiracy to misappropriate or steal trade secrets as part of this data. It's not entirely clear. But I do think that we're going to get some better data on this in the near future. As part of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, the Attorney General's Office, in conjunction with the United States Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator, was supposed to prepare a report no later than a year after its passage and every 2 years thereafter, which analyzed the United States' efforts to combat trade secrets theft. That report's about a year overdue now, but I am happy to report that the draft report was submitted to Congress actually this past Friday. We tried to get it in advance of this webinar so we could provide that information to you, but it hasn't yet been released to the public. Keep an eye out for our blog, for a blog post on this, just trading secrets, and we'll provide a link to the report and some analysis. I'm hopeful that the report will provide some more refined analysis for what piques prosecutors' interest. But here are some of the factors that we've noticed when we look at publicly available information and on the cases where we've worked on that either resulted in a U.S. Attorney's Office prosecution or at least an investigation. So the key factor is pretty much anything with a nexus to defense, as well as what would be characterized as sensitive industries, such as chemical manufacturing, semiconductors, telecommunications, and pharmaceuticals are popular picks for criminal actions. A big reason why is because those are the industries that are most likely to be targeted by foreign governments or state-sponsored corporations. Unsurprisingly, China is the runaway winner in this category, but there's also a smattering of convictions involving Russian and Iranian citizens as well. The involvement of a foreign power, or at least a state-sponsored corporation, is helpful because there are a lot of other, that adds a lot of additional charges that could be brought in a federal prosecution. That gives you the opportunity to bring charges under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, for instance, as well as the Economic Espionage Act. So with limited resources, prosecutors are they like to make statement cases. And so that's one of the big reasons why they focus on cases that involve foreign governments or some kind of state-sponsored enterprise that has a very close tie to a foreign government. The government also likes to go after cases, to use a technical term, flashy scientific stuff. Schematics, blueprints, formulas, things that a layperson can look at, maybe not understand the technical fundamentals, but think, wow, this looks important, are things that often draw prosecutors' interest as well. Though there are cases where the government has gone after someone for the mass misappropriation of confidential information, from a narrative perspective, when you're thinking about building a case, it's easier for the government to build their case around and argue applicable in criminal intent from something where there's a discrete thing that the government can point to as its North Star. To give you a real-life example, we recently worked on a case that involved a pharmaceutical company, and the files that we sort of led with and the ones that got the most interest from the government were actually the PowerPoint presentations, not the underlying factual, not the underlying scientific data, because it had important information in it, along with a disclaimer that it contained confidential and proprietary information. But I think having, you know, the pictures and something else made it so it looked more important, even if the underlying scientific data might have been more useful to some other organization. Finally, prolonged misappropriation or efforts at misappropriation are also preferred. This again relates to providing more cover for the prosecutors. During the course of a prolonged misappropriation, it'll be easier to find violations of other acts. But again, you know, what we're looking at here is a pretty small sample set. Now, I'd view federal prosecutions as a supplement to civil remedies as opposed to an alternative. For instance, in the DuPont-Poland verdict, which is the largest trade secret verdict ever, that was a long-running scheme to steal the manufacturing process for Kevlar. And the case actually, the criminal probe actually started after the civil litigation. So it could be that the government interest is actually piqued by documents that you receive through civil discovery. Further, your primary concern is usually getting back whatever things were taken as quickly as possible. And you might not have the, you probably don't have the luxury to wait around for the government to complete an investigation or send out a target letter. So turning to the private remedies piece of it, we have bilateral, multilateral trade agreements. The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, contained a very strong IP chapter, although it looks like that's on the vine for the time being. It could be revived later on. You have Section 337 under the International Trade Commission. We'll talk a little bit more about how that's applicable to more than just patents. And then finally, you have the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And it has some interesting implications for litigating these claims inside the United States for prosecuting litigations based on foreign conduct. So starting with the International Trade Commission. So this has primarily been a remedy that people have turned to when looking at counterfeit actions for trademarks and patent actions as well. However, you can look towards non-statutory claims. Section 337 allows for a company to petition for the exclusion of goods for entry into the United States for any basis that comes out of an unfair trade practice. Kind of the original decision on this point was the Qian Re Group decision in 2011. In that investigation, the complainant alleged that someone had imported steel railway wheels that were made using trade secrets misappropriated from a licensee in China. And the commission found that even though the misappropriation took place abroad, it nonetheless found a violation and issued a 10-year exclusion order. That's one of the most powerful things that's available under Section 337. A general exclusion order will bar the importation of goods into the United States. You can also obtain a cease and desist letter, which authorizes up to $100,000 per day fine for people who have violated some finding by the International Trade Commission. So since the Qian Re decision, there have been a couple other decisions that where some litigant has used the ITC to obtain relief for claims of foreign theft for trade secrets. And recently, there was actually a case that expanded it and claimed that a company had misappropriated trade secrets by hacking into their domestic systems. That case ended up getting resolved and settled before it actually resulted in a final decision on the merits. But it's nonetheless an interesting concept because, you know, again, we see headlines across the front page all the time talking about the impact of foreign powers or foreign entities breaching computer systems and seeing what you would do about that. It seems like this could be a pretty good remedy going forward to take something that was a purely extraterritorial intrusion into a domestic system and then use that as a basis to exclude goods that were the product of that misappropriated information. The good news about and why these proceedings can be helpful is that they move very fast. It's not uncommon for these proceedings to be resolved entirely within 6 months to 12 months, and they have MREM jurisdiction, meaning that what gives the ITC jurisdiction to decide the dispute is simply having the goods or the goods attempting to be imported into the United States. It avoids some of the choice of law issues that you can run into under the Defend Trade Secrets Act when you're dealing with foreign misappropriation. There's less variation in familiarity with intellectual property law because you're dealing with specialized experts as opposed to a district court judge who or a state court judge who may or may not have a background in this area. But on the downside, it's quite expensive. You generally need to have a dual civil action, meaning that you'll have a civil proceeding going on at the same time as an ITC proceeding. It has questionable applicability to soft trade secrets, like the misappropriation of financial information, which may or may not qualify for trade secrets protection. But it's harder to argue that that has been embodied inside of a tangible physical product. And there is a potential preclusive effect. So if you were to lose before the ITC, it might harm a subsequent civil action. So this is just some disposition information for you. So you can see that the vast majority of the respondents is in Asia, with China and Taiwan taking up 40%. Moreover, you're looking at about a fifth of the time the ITC fines for the complainant, roughly half are settled, and almost the same number, 19%, found no violation. So I'm going to go ahead and skip ahead to the DTSA in practice. So one of the interesting things about this is there's been very little application to foreign misappropriation, which is a little odd because the DTSA has an express provision that authorizes its extraterritorial application. If you have a citizen or a permanent resident alien or an organization organized under the laws of the United States, or if you have an act in furtherance of the offense committed in the United States, the DTSA can apply to that conduct. Under some of the Supreme Court decisions, one of the hardest things to do was to get a United States statute to apply to something that a foreign actor may or may not have done abroad. But given the nature of corporate espionage, you usually have some nexus to the United States. Thus far, there's been not a whole lot of cases that actually develop this, but I think this is something to really keep an eye on, because I wouldn't be surprised if over the next 5 to 10 years, we saw some really significant decisions where some private entities decided to bootstrap this provision to pursue almost entirely international conduct because it has a nexus to the United States. There are, however, some problems when pursuing international misappropriation. The biggest one is personal jurisdiction. In the interim time, there's been a couple of Supreme Court decisions, mainly BNSF Railways and Bristol-Myers Squibb, that have tightened the exercise of general and specific personal jurisdiction. Additionally, you might have a corporation that has a foreign affiliate who engaged in the actual misappropriation, but their actions can generally not be imputed to the domestic corporation. Further, there are some choice of law issues that are implicated when you're dealing with purely extraterritorial conduct. So just a couple of quick takeaways to try to wrap this up, this section up, is that there's been a shift to federal court because of the DTSA. Before it was enacted, you didn't really have a hook to get into federal court other than through the exercise of diversity jurisdiction. So we've seen a lot more of these federal court decisions, a lot more of these decisions come out at the federal level. Further, one thing that we've noticed in litigation is that it's really important, if you can, to have a confidentiality agreement in place. There have been a lot of decisions that we've personally been involved in where the district court sidestepped whether information qualified as a trade secret by simply saying that we don't need to reach that. There's a confidentiality agreement in place. This person took it, and we are going to enjoin them and all individuals or entities acting in concert with them because this certainly qualifies as confidential information. So what we have here is sort of a scatter graph of reported Defend Trade Secret Act decisions. And what this shows is you probably can't even really see the lines connecting each of these, but what we're seeing here is that there's not really a distinct body of law developing for trade secrets decisions. Rather, cases are primarily looking towards state decisions that have and using those to develop what constitutes a trade secret under the DTSA, although some of the state-specific wrinkles in terms of what does or does not qualify as a trade secret have not really been litigated under the DTSA. Finally, one thing just to be aware of is that the DTSA amended the Racketeer Influence to Corrupt Organizations Act to find that using trade secrets itself is a predicate act, and this opens up the door to having RICO claims based on the misappropriation of trade secrets. That was something that was not available under prior to the amendments under the DTSA. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan.
Well, thanks, Alex. With so many different issues to consider, it's not surprising that these issues present a potent challenge to multinational corporations. And fortunately, there are a lot of proactive steps that employers can take to maximize their ability to protect their trade secrets and other information. As an overarching consideration, companies really should consider how they can best create a culture of compliance in the employment space. And in this, we're indebted to work done by our friends at PwC and Create.org, who have participated with us in webinars in the past. And they've together come up with a five-step approach for companies to use in assessing how best to protect their trade secrets. We think that five-step approach is helpful here, and it's really an individualized assessment for particular employees, or at least particular types of employees within the organization. You can see the five questions listed on the slide. It comes down to, I won't read the questions because you can see it there, but what kind of information do these employees have access to? And what do you need to do as an organization to minimize the ability of employees to use that information or otherwise to harm your interests with respect to that information. In light of this analysis, one of the first things that's useful for companies to do is consider what type of agreement you want to have in place for employees at the onboarding process. In most cases, you'll want to have a non-disclosure provision, perhaps an invention assignment provision, but you'll want to consider what kinds of restricted covenants and other covenants that you need to have with specific types of employees. You know, Marjorie already mentioned that one size does not fit all. That's true in the international context, and that's true purely in the U.S. We realize that as a matter of necessity, most employers have to operate off of templates. There's really no way to efficiently recreate the wheel for every single employee. But templates should be a starting point for adjusting agreements to comply with local requirements. In the U.S., it's a good idea to have a few template multi-state agreements that vary in their protections for different types of employees. And then for states that have very quirky rules, consider varying those agreements for states, just as in the international context, you want to make sure whatever covenants you're including in your employment agreements are ones that are going to pass muster under local law that's applicable. The same analysis applies at other points in the employment relationship and not just at the onboarding process. For example, when employees are terminated, companies might want to include restricted covenants in severance agreements, as long as that's permitted by local law, or require employees to reaffirm their existing obligations in exchange for severance benefits. Again, make sure that your approach complies with local law. This is especially important in the international context because in most countries, unlike in the U.S., certain severance benefits are already required by law. And so you certainly need to make sure that whatever you're doing in your agreements is going to comply with local requirements, and don't assume that what you have in your U.S. agreements is going to apply across the board. Also, don't forget creative approaches. Depending on the threat that a type of employee can pose, you might consider providing employees with incentives, such as equity or stock options, that, if you can do this legally, are tied to the employee's compliance with loyalty provisions. You might also consider requiring certain employees to provide a notice period before they resign and the option of the company to place the employees on garden leave for some period of time. That's a mechanism that is really not used that often in the U.S., but under most states' laws, there's no reason why you could not have some kind of a garden leave built into the agreement, just keeping in mind that if somebody is going to go to work for a competitor, you can't enjoin in the U.S. an employee from leaving the company altogether. You can only enjoin them from violating a non-compete agreement. It's also important to implement procedures to ensure that employees return all company property at the time of the termination. Conducting exit interviews and reminding employees of their continuing obligations are helpful steps in this process, but the steps that the company takes should be tailored to the particular type of employee. What might be a prudent course of action with respect to one employee could very well be overkill with respect to another employee. As a general practice, it's prudent to coordinate exit interviews among all organizations of the company that need to be involved, and this is especially the case with IT and HR. Although this might be an obvious point, IT department should ensure that all company property, hardware, and devices have been returned, including any email and cloud data, as well as social media accounts. And in this regard, it's a good idea if it's appropriate and if it's consistent with applicable law to check an employee's computer activities and work activities in advance of the exit interview, especially if there's reason to believe that the employee is going to work for a competitor. But do ensure that your review complies with privacy laws, which tend to be much more fulsome in other parts of the world than they are in the U.S. Again, it might be an obvious point, but employers should ensure that arrangements have been made to have all company data removed from personal devices and that the employee's access to computer networks has been disabled. In addition, consistent with the company's social media policy, the company should obtain the usernames and passwords for all company social media accounts, and I stress that this applies to company social media accounts. Purely personal social media accounts are a different story, and in most jurisdictions, including in the U.S., employers generally cannot access employees' personal social media accounts except in very limited circumstances. Employers should also consider sending a letter to the employee and his or her new employer, reminding them of continuing obligations. You might perhaps consider requiring the employee to provide a written certification of his or her compliance. Depending on the level of the employee and the likelihood of litigation, you might also consider having the employee's emails preserved and forensically imaged if that's something that you're permitted to do by local law. And again, you'll want to check on that to make sure that that's permitted. Finally, after the exit interview, you should consider conducting a post-termination investigation of certain employees' activities if you've determined that some further analysis is necessary because it's suspected that the employee might either be working for a competitor or has perhaps taken some company data on the way out the door. Once again, these activities should be conducted in a manner that's consistent with local law. However, to the extent that it's permitted, you might interview an employee's coworkers, gauge what they're hearing, if anything, about the employee in the marketplace, examine the employee's email activity, conduct an investigation of the employee's computer activities, analyze and examine badge records and access logs to see if there was any strange behavior in the weeks leading up to the employee's departure. You might examine the employee's company phone records to see if there was any unusual activity with respect to calls made. You might check the employee's publicly available social media accounts to see if they are indicating that they're now employed by a competitor. Again, all of this does need to be done with an eye towards complying with whatever the local law is. One practical illustration of the benefits of this kind of post-termination investigation comes from a Boston Globe article that was published a few years back. We don't have the citation on the slide, but the story was entitled "Ex-Intel Worker Gets 3 Years for Stealing Secrets." That was published in the August 9, 2012 edition of the Boston Globe. And according to that story, an Intel engineer had accepted a job with a competitor, but he told Intel that he planned to work for a hedge fund and wanted to take 2 weeks of vacation before his last day. While he was still on the company's payroll, the employee began working for a competitor and secretly downloaded manufacturing and design documents, that were worth between $200 to $400 million. Fortunately, the company was very proactive. They did a routine review of the employee's emails, and they fortunately discovered what he had done. Ultimately, the plot was averted, and the former employee was sentenced to 3 years in prison. But the consequences could have been disastrous if Intel had not acted proactively in reviewing the employee's emails. And certainly there are a lot of other companies that probably would not be as proactive as Intel was here. This is a great example of the value of computer forensic examinations in this context. Along the same lines, Alex, I understand that CNBC recently published a similar story. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that you see is that's actually happened in a surprising number of SEC cases is there's an insider trader who gets caught because they Google how to avoid insider trading charges or something similar around the same time that they engage in the inappropriate activity. And we actually had something similar happen in one of our recent cases as well with a foreign national who, at the same time that he was downloading tens of thousands of files from his employer, he was Googling and looking at indictments that had been filed against foreign nationals, and was looking into, you know, trade secret Googling trade secret criminal charges and things like that. And so, you know, if you're talking about the intent to show misappropriation, sometimes an individual's search history and computer activity could be a really phenomenal way to show that.
Well, thank you. Once again, a practical tip to consider as you're trying to navigate these issues. Well, we've now come to the end of our time that's been allotted, but before we close, we do want to take a few minutes for discussions. And I'll turn it over to the presenter for instructions about how to submit questions.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll conduct the question and answer session. To ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way, and we are now ready to begin.
We have one question that's come in by the chat, and that's, for NDAs with third parties, do you recommend arbitration, for example, to the ICC, with the right to request injunctive relief from any court or jurisdiction, court of jurisdiction, or courts only? You know, this is really an important strategic question that companies should consider. There are some great benefits to arbitration. There are some downsides to arbitration. I think at a minimum, you certainly want to keep open the possibility of getting immediate injunctive relief from a court of competent jurisdiction in aid of arbitration, at least in the U.S. Arbitration is really not set up to provide immediate remedies in a way that court is. And so at least in the U.S., I think you would probably want to have that ability to get an immediate injunctive relief, even if the ultimate ruling on the merits is going to be decided by an arbitrator. Marjorie, any thoughts on that in the international context?
So I think when you're talking about arbitration, generally when it comes to employment type issues, arbitration is very difficult to enforce, particularly when someone has been employed in the particular country. I think it might be easier, again, in a global mobility situation where someone is moving around to different countries. But when it comes to employment and non-competes, the courts in the local jurisdiction will not refer to arbitration, even if the employee and the employer have agreed to that.
Another question we have, I think this is best directed at Paul. Paul, you mentioned that in the UK, claims of misappropriation of trade secrets historically have been brought as common law breach of confidence claims. Now there's this the UK trade secrets regulations. You know, we've seen a similar thing in the U.S. with the varying approach of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act versus the Defend Trade Secrets Act as to whether it preempts common law claims. With these new regs in the UK, do they displace common law claims for breach of confidence?
So that's a great question, Dan. So what it appears as right now is that the UK is attempting to, in the short term, weave the new UK statute into the common law breach of confidence case law. Basically, what that is doing is allowing common law claims to still be permissible and kind of phase it out, I think, over time. However, the regulations, I believe in Section 3-2, of the new regulation still allows for a breach of confidence to be brought where the secret is not necessarily protected under the new regulation, giving it kind of a broader power. So essentially the new law does provide for the ability to still bring breach of confidence claims almost as like a catch-all if you need it.
Well, thanks for that clarification, Paul. Well, I'm afraid that that's all we have time for today. I know we have a few other questions, and if you submitted a question and it wasn't answered, we will be following up with you by email. And if you have any other questions at all, please don't hesitate to reach out to any of today's speakers. On the second to last slide, which is on the screen right now, you'll find contact information for Marjorie, Paul, Alex, and me. And we'd love to hear from you if you have any comments or questions. Before I hand it over to our presenter to wrap this up, I just want to thank you all for your participation today. And if you have any more questions or just to keep up with more information in this interesting area of law, we do encourage you to reach out to us, but also to check out our Trade Secrets blog. That's at www.tradesecretslawyer.com. As Alex mentioned, we'll be having some updates on these issues in the days and weeks ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.